Well, Merry Christmas and welcome to the annual Christmas special of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Rao. And I've got my Christmas things here. I've got my jingle bells, Ricardo, because you know how much I care about this stuff.
Yeah, it's a great special. I love it.
So as usual, we are looking at three Christmas-themed films.
We are.
For that seasonal joy.
Of course.
And the first one of those is the 2005 French film, or multilingual film, Joyeux Noël.
The second film we are discussing is a Finnish film from 2010 called Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale.
And I'm just so reining myself in to make lots of jokes about the fact we finished the film. But anyway, and the third film is going to be the 1994 Hollywood blockbuster-ish film with Tim Allen called The Santa Claus.
Mm.
So settle back. Warm up or chill your eggnog, depending on where you are. We're in the warmer climes, as usual.
That's right.
But, hey, Ricardo, why don't you tell us about the first film, and I'm dying to hear how you pronounce it.
Okay, Joyeux Noël.
That's not bad.
Directed beautifully by Christian Carrion, this 2005 film begins with three scenes of schoolboys from Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, reciting patriotic speeches that both praise their countries and condemn their enemies. Now, it's a powerful opening that makes the story to follow even more compelling. These kids were brought up in hatred of each other. It's World War I, and Europe is thrown into violent and brutal chaos as men are forced into the ugliness that is war. Whilst the battlefield soaks in blood, Christmas approaches. Now, this story focuses mainly upon six characters. Gordon, Alex Ferns, a lieutenant of the Royal Scots Fusiliers. Aldebert, Guillaume Canet, a French lieutenant of the 26th Infantry. Horstmeier, Daniel Brühl, a Jewish-German lieutenant of the 93rd Infantry. Palmer, Gary Lewis, a Scottish priest working as a stretcher-bearer. And famous opera singers Nikolaus Sprink, Benno Fehrmann, and his Danish fiancée Anna Sorensen, Diane Kruger. All of them are fighting one another on the Western Front. Now, in Germany, Anna gets permission to perform for the soldiers, and Sprink is allowed to accompany her. When the fighting subsides for the evening, and the beautifully sung Christmas carols by Anna and Nikolaus are heard by all, something happens. It's Christmas, and they face a transformation, even for a short while, toward peace and goodwill. Against all odds, these individuals from opposing sides step into no man's land and bond during this bloodless respite to experience the hope and goodness in humanity. Now, based on a true story, this film is able to do something very difficult, bring all the feels of the Christmas spirit amongst a very harsh and brutal backdrop. It's technically very well made, from the gorgeous cinematography by Walther van der Ende to the music by Philippe Rombi. It's very easy to watch on the eyes. The one thing it fails to do, however, is really make us feel for all these characters. I feel the film's pacing is also very one note, pretty much the same the whole way through. But I do feel like this was a choice by the filmmakers, wanting to focus on the actual moment itself, which is absolutely beautiful, and I think it's a story that was meant to be told. Greg, what did you think about Joyeux Noël?
I didn't love it. I thought I would. I wanted to, and I didn't. And I think what you allude to towards the end of your intro is at part of what's at the heart of it, that it was very one note. You know, when I sat back and reflected on this film, I was reminded of my response to Spotlight that was up for the Oscars a few years ago, you know, quite recently. And for both those films, I already knew the story. I'm Catholic. You know, I know the kinds of things that, you know, in a general sense, I know the kind of things that happened in the Catholic Church, you know, the organisational machinations and iniquity of, you know, how priests were shuffled around because they were interfering with children. So I knew that story locally as well as from reading overseas. This story I also knew. I knew what happened. And this, in fact, is an exemplar of something that's happening that particular Christmas up and down the lines. I hadn't realised. I thought there was just the one event.
Yeah.
But, in fact, it was happening in a few different places along the line for that very first Christmas.
Right, right.
So if I didn't know the story, maybe that's enough, you know, but it tells you something. And the miracle of this film is, as you say, it's a true story, which tells you something just so deeply marvellous.
Absolutely.
That in a situation which usually is, and for them had been, you know, callous disregard for human life, shoot or be shot stuff, and I don't want to trivialise war, to something where the common humanity just burst through. And I found myself also thinking, now, would that happen these days? Because although, as you say, the opening where you see the schoolboys being raised in that kind of xenophobia, they do have things in common. They're from the same part of the world. They do have a common kind of history-ish. And what I found really interesting in the film is that when they came together for the Christmas Mass, it was in Latin.
Yeah, right.
So as I'm assuming they were all, if not Catholics, you know, they're obviously Christian.
Mm.
So they actually do have a common language to a point. Now, if you tried to say, would this story happen today in a war between, say, Western versus Middle Eastern groups, would they even have that in common? It's not to say they wouldn't have humanity in common, but would it find like a meeting point or an outlet? Mm. And for this film, because I knew the story and because I know, in general terms, the spotlight story, for me, the film has to do something a bit extra.
Mm.
It has to emotionally engage me. And as you say, there were moments, but overall it didn't.
I think humanity in the end, and the human side of it, it transcends even Christmas. So
I got emotional when the tenor opera singer first comes out singing Adeste Fidelis, yes. Come All Ye Faithful, bearing that Christmas tree, which was all a bit bizarre that they were there in the first place, but comes out and just takes that brave step. I felt it at that point, but it was one of the very few times that I felt. And selfishly, perhaps, I thought this film would make me feel, and I could almost revel in that humanity, and I didn't get there.
It got close in parts, you know. Yeah. I think once they, you know, when they made the second truce in order to bury the dead, and when, you know, I think once they saw the humanity, they couldn't unsee the humanity once they were faced with it. And
that made them, in the terms of the film, it made them ineffective as soldiers. They were getting shipped off to other places or, you know, you've done it now kind of stuff.
That's right, exactly.
But historically, as I understand it, that didn't happen. They weren't in trouble for being human, but the forces that be clamped down the following Christmas to make sure that couldn't happen again.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, that became one of the weaknesses of the film. And, you know, I'm an old-time, you know, sentimentalist and so on.
So am I.
I wanted to know what happened to them afterwards.
Mm.
I wanted to know if the German commanding officer, Daniel Brühl, whether he would actually go back to the inn on Rue Auvin, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And, like, would they both survive the war and would they be able to embrace with their humanity 4 years later, after the worst of the war was really happening. I was curious about that. I wanted to know more.
Well, they didn't have any place cards to say, this person did this, this person did this.
Place cards. I thought you meant they set up a dining table in the middle of the battlefield and you sit there.
No.
Oh, look, I'm next to him, I don't like him.
I mean in the credits, you know, to say, you know, this character went on to do this and this character went on to do that, or this one got killed in the barrel. Exactly. So they didn't do that.
No.
Which is good.
No.
Because I think it is about the moment. It is really about the moment.
Well, no, see, that's the thing. It is about the moment, but I think I would have been more intrigued if it was about beyond the moment as well, which they started to touch on. It was all fairly negative. That if you could know, could they actually continue to hold that? As the war and the atrocities got worse, could they actually hold on to it or not? I actually wouldn't mind seeing that story.
Mm.
When you mentioned the powerful opening, and I agree, I thought some of the strongest parts of the film were the opening scenes.
Yeah, very, very strong opening.
But you skipped one. So before the boys in the schoolrooms reciting the nationalist poetry with the opening titles, there are a number of photographs that seem to be photographic recreations of Impressionist paintings.
Yeah, you're right.
There were five or six of them. I recognised two of them.
That
I think one of them was that famous Renoir painting of the Riverside Picnic.
Mm-hmm.
And the one with the woman standing with her her red umbrella, I think was meant to be reminiscent of a Manet painting that I know and really quite like.
I think the children because I knew what the story was going to be about, and so I thought it was just a very good opening.
The reason I like those painting recreations is that I understood that to be a reflection of ordinary society in a very cultured society in time, you know, late 19th, early 20th century in France, showing that and then showing the stuff that was kind of creepy at the same time in the schoolrooms, and then we get into, you know, the full-on war. What did you make of the female opera singer?
Again, she was fine, but she was just like, you know, the other characters. I couldn't really feel for the characters much at all.
I wonder what she was doing there.
Yeah.
I would be surprised. I'm not a historian, but I would be surprised if she had would have been allowed anywhere near the front line.
It
was lovely that she was there and she was bringing a bit of home and femaleness to that environment.
Yes.
So it's almost a kind of a metaphor in the film. I get that. But because it's meant to be a true story, I was just sitting there thinking,
I was thinking that. I was thinking, wow, would she be really allowed on the front line like that? I mean, they are in battle every day.
Mm.
They're in the trenches.
Yeah, I know.
Would she really be allowed there?
The other thing I liked about the opening of the film was the scene in, I assume, the Scottish Highlands, where the character played by Stephen Robertson, who you didn't mention, he was the one who's kind of going mad because his brother had died.
Yes, right.
He seems to have, that guy, I've seen a few things now, he seems to have cornered the market on being the new Anthony Perkins. Like, mm-hmm. He does that kind of hysterical, you know.
Look, there's so many characters in here. It was hard to mention everyone.
Well, Ian Richardson.
Yeah, okay.
Wonderful Sir Ian Richardson doing the cameo as the bishop and giving a sermon on Jesus coming to divide the world with a sword.
Yeah.
Being used as a justification for war.
See, again, I think there's so many characters. I felt disjointed that way. You know, and it felt like one note throughout the whole thing as well. So you've got all these characters you're being introduced to. You're hearing these other
people. You're kind of hopping around between them.
You're hopping around between them.
I did like that opening scene in the Scottish chapel where the Stephen Robertson character and the priest, the minister, are there, and Stephen Robertson's character is painting the statue and the priest is, you know, lighting the candles. Then the other guy comes rushing in. I think it's meant to be Stephen Robertson's brother, ringing the bell to announce the war. I'm very excited. We're off to have an adventure,
right.
Which I understand was in Australia as well, was what was going on from having watched Gallipoli.
Yeah.
But the way he came rushing in, and then the other young guy, Stephen Robertson's character, went rushing out after him, and all the candles blow out because he's opened the door and let the outside world in. So the piece of the church candles blown out and all the kind of the smoke drifting up. And then the minister turns around and looks at the crucifix and just wordlessly is just looking up and you can see he's saying, what the hell is going on?
That's
how can
right.
this happen?
Mm-hmm.
What's it going to mean? What about my faith?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought the opening scenes in some ways were the most powerful in the whole film.
They were. I think the first quarter was fantastic. I think it fell away a bit. But you know which scene I really loved? The very end.
The train?
The train. When
Why?
The Germans are singing the Scottish song.
Oh, yes. Okay, yes.
You know, that was beautiful. And it was a perfect way to end that story. And it just showed that...
Well, the common humanity lingers on, hopefully.
Yes.
You know, the thing about the Scottish characters, you and I watched the same copy of this film that provided subtitles for the French and German characters, but not more, I don't know if you noticed, not other subtitles.
No.
Because sometimes I hadn't had a clue what the Scottish characters were saying, and I was turning the subtitles on saying, oh, and it wasn't there, and I was thinking, okay, I know that they're not speaking English, the French and Germans, but I'm not entirely sure the Scots are either.
Mm.
And I just pre-apologise to any Scottish listeners who might happen to have. But, and let me say, I love a good Scottish accent, but I also want to understand what's being said in terms of the narrative.
Yeah.
And there was one great line I loved in the film. So the senior French officer, whose father was obviously some major general, senior officer, when he comes in and he finally gets told that he's a grandfather of a boy, you know, Henri, he says to his son, I was ordered to arrest the cat for high treason. And that was based on truth, I found out.
Oh, wow.
Where they shot a cat because they had a note attached running from one place to another. So they were drawing on that as well. But it's a great line. I almost want it on a T-shirt, you know. I was ordered to arrest the cat for high treason.
Yeah, that is
Guess
a good
the
line.
Source.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, in the spirit of Christmas, where would you rate this?
I'm giving it a 6 out of 10.
And why is that?
Well, I just think it lacked the emotional connection for me. I understood what they were trying to do, and I did feel, you know, emotionally connected to the moment. This is not a low score. Six is quite a good score.
You said that before, actually, yeah.
Okay, so I'm not, you know, I'm not saying it's a bad film. It is a good film, and it's definitely worth a watch, and it's great to witness it and to see this lovely moment on film.
I had the same overall response to you, but I gave it a 7 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's because... You know, I feel bad. I want it to be an 8, 9 or even a 10.
Yeah, me too. I wanted it to be an 8.
But it's only a 7, and it's because, you know, it tells a really important story that we need to understand. I think it throws in complicating factors like the female soprano visiting the trenches, and I did feel emotionally disengaged for most of the film. And I think you're right. Some of the problems are just how it hops from character to character. So that's why I mark it down, but... Maybe the 7's a bit wishful, maybe it really is a 6, but I do think as a true story, it's important.
It is very important. Yeah, I agree.
And so, you know, maybe I would mark it down on more reflection, but I still would say, look, watch it. It's an important thing to understand.
So So the second film we're going to discuss in this Christmas special is Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale. Take it away, Greg.
Well, I feel like because it's a Finnish film, I should be saying her or something, but I can't do those vowel sounds. Anyway, this 2010 Finnish film is a prequel to two short films featuring many of the same actors. And both these films are about 7 minutes long, and one's called Rare Exports Inc., 2003, and the other's called Rare Exports, The Official Safety Instructions, 2005. In this prequel, a company has fenced off a snowy, remote mountain in Finland for an archaeological dig down into the mountain's heart in December, searching for something that is clearly an obsession for their employer, Riley, Per Christian Elifson. Watching them are two local boys, including Pietari, Oni Tomila, who have cut and sneaked through a wire fence to witness the dig. What he sees inspires Pietari to do some research, and in some ancient texts conveniently located in his remote village, he finds some less appealing stories about Father Christmas, a series of Krampus-like legends about bearded demons who like to punish children. A few weeks later, on Christmas Eve, Pietari is convinced that he's being watched by such a creature. But in the manner of these stories, he doesn't tell anyone, including his father, Rauno, Jorma Tomila, who must be the child actor's father. Rather, he sets a series of traps and keeps his new loaded rifle close to hand. Rauno, his father, has set a pretty nasty and illegal trap for the wolves he believes have slaughtered the local reindeer on which the villagers rely for their income. But Rauno discovers he has trapped and killed an old man. Or has he? This tight narrative has fun with the tropes of Santa, reimagining him as something more dangerous, all in the context of a horror action film. The ending is particularly inspired, although you should watch this prequel before you watch the two shorter films so as not to spoil the fun. This feature film was enough to get writer-director Jalmari Helander to Hollywood, where he wrote and directed 2014's Big Game, starring Samuel L. Jackson and his really rather amazing child star and his father. But I have to say, I prefer the two shorter films, which we'll also link to in our podcast episode profile. I find these more complete as capsules of po-faced whimsy than this longer-form adventure. But Ricardo, what did you think?
I didn't see the short films. I only saw the feature. And I quite enjoyed this. I thought it was a bit clunky in terms of its narrative. I thought technically it was very good, beautifully filmed and beautifully directed. You know, it was such a great visual style to it. To me, it was just a bit of fun fodder. There's the Krampus story, which is we talked about previously in the last Christmas special.
I think it might have been two.
Look, I wasn't scared by it. It was intriguing through the majority of it. Again, did I care for anybody? Not really. Even the kid at the end, I wasn't feeling really like, oh, wow, he's going to die. And it was intriguing. And it was a fun little ride. Will I watch it again? I don't think so.
No.
Was I scared? Not really.
Yeah, and you're a horror film fan.
I like horror. Yeah. But it's competently made, and you watch it and you go, okay, this is okay, and it's a bit of fun, but that's about it.
I think this is another example of something you and I have talked about at least once before, where someone has made a short film that's been successful, and they then decide to expand it into a feature film off the back of it.
There's not enough
content, and that's the problem.
I mean, it's only an hour and 20 minutes that shows.
The two short films are enough for me. I'm not a horror fan, as we all know, and I...
He's growing on them.
No. I was getting ready to be scared and feeling uncomfortable about that because of what I'd heard about this film. And the fact that in Australia, at least, it's rated MA, which is one where you don't quite have to be 18 years old to see
That's
it.
Right.
So I thought it was going to be a lot more full-on than it actually was. I wasn't entirely sure what it was in the end. It was a bit of a ride. I think the child actor is very, very good.
He's very good. Yeah. In fact, all the performances are great.
And
like I said, technically it ticks all the boxes when it comes to cinematography, for the effects, for the
story. The child actor, he is in the more recent of the two prequels. And at that stage, he's only about maybe 5 years old. And he's very good in that as well. But I have to say, I got very worried about the fact that his dad had given him a new gun for Christmas.
I think it was loaded.
Wandering around with this loaded gun over his shoulder. And I was waiting for something to go horribly wrong with that.
It's got the worst title ever, Rare Exports. Really.
Well, but I think that's leveraging the success of the two short films.
I know.
The other thing that was interesting about this story was that there were no women anywhere.
No, there wasn't.
There was no attempt to contextualise where the mother was. No. Had she died? Had she
no,
left them?
They could have done much more with that.
They could have expanded the story and made it richer. So, you know, male policemen, male neighbours, male Santa creatures, obviously.
Yeah.
There were children, but the only time you really saw the children outside of Saxe, just to spoil a little bit maybe,
yeah,
was the boy who went up the mountain with him.
Yes.
You didn't see the other children.
Not at all.
And I
didn't feel that.
I found it odd.
I didn't feel that community. Like, I thought all these kids are there. I had no idea about the community and whether they've been taken and they've been, like, all of that. It was just suddenly there's heaps of people in bags. I didn't really...
And the hunters, the farmer-hunter characters... Mm. They were, for me, they went from, we've killed someone and get found out, to, we'll just kind of cut up the body and get rid of it.
Mm.
There was no kind of moral
journey there. That was a weird scene when they were going to cut up the body and
So maybe that's an expression of the toughness of that remote community.
I was like, they've captured this poor person. They're talking about him being 60 and he's died early or, you know, that sort of thing. And then they're about to cut up the body.
Yes.
Really? I mean, that's one thing to cut up open a pig, like you say at the very beginning. But
yes,
it's another thing to cut open a body that you've just found to get rid of.
Yes.
That's another thing. And I just thought it was really odd because I wasn't following... I didn't think that character... I didn't know what those characters were trying to do.
I think they jumped too soon from those two short films where the characters aren't as important because they're actually telling about this weird kind of setup around Santa's. Mm. And that's okay in these like 6-7 minute capsules. But in this film, there wasn't enough expansion of the stories, their emotional journeys, their moral arc, even down to what actually happened on top of the mountain. So the archaeological dig,
yes,
they break through. And then the next thing when you're up there, which is later in the film, obviously, is where the villagers go up to demand justice because they think that the dig has caused wolves to get out and kill the reindeer. So they're angry. They want compensation.
Yes.
And they get there and you almost find out nothing about what happened.
No.
Except when the helicopter arrives. And that's over really quickly as well.
I know.
And so it's...
That's why I call it clunky.
Yes. I made a note to myself, weird, unbelievable and schlocky.
Yes. And it could have been much more because I really like that story. The story's... And it's really well made. It's, again, the screenplay. I think they could have done so much more with that in the feature context. So it's a bit of a waste because
the director
clearly has vision and a great premise.
Well, I'm not sure if his American film went so well either, The Big Game. But I also do think the very last moments of the film are a good payoff.
Yes, they are.
When you see what's going on. And this logo you've seen all the way through the film.
Yes.
Suddenly you realise what it means.
Yeah.
Let's leave this one.
Yes.
By saying, score-wise?
I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10.
I'm the same, actually.
Yeah. Again, it's not a bad film. It's well made, but it's just a bit clunky.
For me, it's a 5 out of 10. I expected to give this maybe a 7 or 8 before I watched it. Being, you know, a bit... Oh my God, it's a horror film, but it was a clever horror film is what I expected, and it just doesn't get there. My advice is you can watch this film or not, but go and watch the short ones that we will link to. They're fun.
Yeah, I'm going to watch them.
So our third and final film for this episode is probably the best known of the three because, you know, it was a big Hollywood film in its time. Ricardo, why don't you bring us into it?
Okay, The Santa Claus. Directed by John Pasquin, who also directed Miss Congeniality 2 and the Home Improvement TV series, this 1994 Christmas comedy centres around divorcee Scott Calvin, Tim Allen, a man who works in the toy business. Scott is not happy to learn that his ex-wife Laura, Wendy Crewson, and her new husband, psychologist Neil, Judge Reinhold, have tried to convince their 6-year-old son Charlie that Santa isn't real.
What?!
We'll talk about this later.
What? Hang on. I believe.
Okay, ready? Charlie has to reluctantly spend Christmas Eve with his dad, and Scott presents himself as a tad hopeless, burning dinner and opting for takeaway. After reading The Night Before Christmas before bed, Charlie hears noises on the roof. Charlie calls for Dad, who goes outside, calls out to Santa on the roof, who falls, killing him. Uh-oh. Santa disappears, however, leaving 8 reindeer and their sleigh and a Santa suit with instructions to put it on if Santa's involved in an accident. Scott does this and is suddenly flown around the town, miraculously dropping gifts through chimneys until he's taken to the North Pole and informed by Santa's elves that he is now Santa. Charlie and his dad bond beautifully through all this, and he loves his dad's new job, although Scott is completely convinced it's a dream. Seems he himself has trouble believing. Until his hair turns white, his beard refuses to stay shaved, and he gains a heap of weight through his sudden love of comfort food. Now he's accepted it, there's just one problem. How to keep it secret from his ex-wife and psychologist husband, who think he's crazy and poses a threat to the kid. Now, I remember this when it came out, and although I never saw it, it was a hit. Tim Allen was at the top of his game at the time, as Home Improvement was also very popular at the time. Having seen it now with my 8-year-old son, I liked it. I feel it plays way too heavily on Santa not being real, however. I think it can actually implant the thoughts of it in children who are not really ready to think this way. I also feel it took too long to get Tim actually becoming Santa. But kudos has to be given to the makeup department here, who do a great and very believable job in this transformation. But besides the film taking a little bit of time to take off, it does tend to find its feet and warm us with the Christmas spirit. Greg?
Well, you've just shattered my belief system. So just give me a moment, folks. I'll be fine. Hang on. I actually brought Santa with me. Okay, I feel better. The thing that you said towards the end, I really agree with. The makeup department here is fantastic.
Yeah, very good.
And I watched this with my younger son, and he was saying to me two or three times, is that the same actor?
Yeah.
Like he didn't quite believe me, because he does transform.
Yeah.
And that really stands out in contrast with the special effects, the CGI kind of stuff, which now looks really dated and clunky.
Absolutely.
And you and I were talking earlier about watching the new Netflix Christmas film, Christmas Chronicles, where Kurt Russell plays Santa. And the special effects in that are of the moment.
They are.
And watching those two only a night or two apart, the 1994 one really has dated in that sense. But the makeup is superb.
The makeup is so good.
That old craft.
Yes, yes, very, very good. And see, it's all makeup.
Yes.
And he looks the part, and they do it very well.
And acting. I'm not with you. I don't particularly like this film. I'm a bit surprised to hear you say that you hadn't seen it before, because you were saying, let's watch this film because it's a classic, and I thought that you loved it.
No, because I hadn't seen it.
And I was thinking, okay, I'll watch it.
I knew it was a hit, but I never saw it.
I saw it when it came out. I saw it at the drive-in, actually. I remember that very clearly. And I remember one scene that I wanted to see again. It was almost the only scene I could remember from the whole film, which is, how does Santa get into a house if there's no chimney?
Yes.
And he goes to that house with the little girl on the couch. And I won't spoil it, folks, but it's a lovely answer to that question. And in the context of the film, it makes sense. But those moments for me were few and far between. I am very about Tim Allen.
Yeah.
I think he is perfect in Galaxy Quest, which I think we should talk about one day.
I haven't seen it.
I love Galaxy Quest. By and large, I'm not a fan of Tim Allen's style. He's great for Buzz Lightyear.
He's great as Buzz Lightyear.
But I don't have to look at him.
Yeah.
For me, this is one of those Hollywood films that feels like a Hollywood film, and no one in the film feels real to me. It's people like acting out a story in not even a mythic kind of way. And it sounds like there's a number of off-the-cuff one-liners from Tim Allen, and that it just doesn't work for me.
I watched Home Improvement when I was in the 90s, so I quite liked Tim Allen in that. So I'm surprised I never saw this, but it was not at the cinema at the time. And then it was on video. I mean, we never hired it. It was, you know, it was different to nowadays. But I quite like Tim Allen. I like his style. I don't mind him. I won't watch everything he's in, but I thought he was at the top of his game here.
Yeah, see, I don't. I always feel like Tim Allen is playing Tim Allen, playing the character. And I felt that way when I saw, I think it's called Sky High, where he was in a high school for superheroes. And again, I just feel like it's the same character. It works for the James Kirk kind of character in Galaxy Quest, because that's the kind of character he's playing. And it really works there. But by and large, not so much. And for me, whether or not you like Tim Allen will pretty much define whether or not you like this film.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I was watching this film this time around, I found myself thinking a lot about, is there someone who could do this better? And you know who I came up with?
Who?
Tom Hanks, his Toy Story buddy. It's probably unimaginative casting.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about Polar Express, which I think we talked about last Christmas.
We did, yeah.
And I just thought, you know, I think Tom Hanks could pull this off. That every man, you know, not quite muddling through, but has the warmth that could really come out. And you know, he'd done things like Big by that stage and Splash with that fantasy element. I'd like to have seen this with Tom Hanks.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
And for me, the low point of the film was the ZZ Top joke, where Santa and some of the elves and Santa's son are walking down the corridor at the North Pole, and there's a ZZ Top kind of tune playing, and Santa's got his beard, and they're walking in that kind of style. And I thought, yeah, this is the moment in the film. It represents to me why I don't particularly like it.
Mm.
And I actually thought it went downhill as it went. I felt like they were shoveling in lots of stuff. So they shoveled in that Q kind of character.
I thought it got better as it went.
The ELFS squad. I just thought, oh, they're just throwing things into the plot to keep it moving.
But
can I just say, bah humbug.
Yeah. I didn't love the film. I thought it was a good movie. I thought it was okay, but I didn't love it. I mean, I'm not going to give it a 10, put it that way.
Mm.
Okay, bit of a spoiler alert there, but I'm not going to give it a 10. And it does try and do too much, okay? But I quite like that there was a touch of Miracle on 34th Street in there as well.
Well, that was explicitly referenced by one of the characters watching that on TV.
Yeah, and which I just watched the remake for the first time.
And?
I really liked it.
Did you?
Yes, I did. I loved Richard Attenborough in it. We did the original.
Young Natalie Wood.
Yes, and I loved the remake. I thought they did it very, very nicely. But getting back to the Santa Claus, it does what it's meant to do, Greg. It actually does make you feel like there's the Christmas spirit, it's Father Christmas. I thought the first half, like I said in my opening, really, they've got to be careful. They really have to be careful with the whole Santa Claus is not real. They harped on about him not being real and all the rest of it to the six-year-old. They really went to town on it.
Partly what you're saying is, who's this film for?
Yes.
Is it for the little kids or the grown-ups?
No, it's for the kids.
Well, not given what you're saying now, actually, it's not, because there's almost a callous disregard for that.
Well, there is. I think there is a disregard for it. And I knew it is a kids' film. It's rated what? G, isn't it? G-rated movie.
It's G or PG,
and it's a kids' film when it was marketed as a kids' film. So,
well, a family film, but yeah.
As a family film. But then, yeah, but saying that, you're going to watch it with the kids. And
yep.
The kids are going to hear all this and put these little thoughts in their head at ages which they shouldn't be thinking about that.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought it was a little bit irresponsible to harp on about it too much in the screenplay-wise.
Particularly because Santa's real.
It's a big thing. It's a big thing. You can't take that lightly, screenwriters.
My favourite character in the film, and it took a while for this to be true, was Judge Reinhold as the new husband, the stepfather.
I find Judge Reinhold hard to watch because I just think of him as Billy in Beverly Hills Cop.
I haven't seen that.
I've tried to watch him in Serious Things. I've tried to watch him in Xanderly with Nicolas Cage. I cannot watch. He's Billy. And I'm sorry, Judge Reinhold, if you actually do listen to this episode. I can't.
Love your jumpers, mate. You know, great jumpers. But I believed him at the end. When Santa gives the mother and the stepfather the presents that they never got as kids, and you could see that coming a mile off.
Mm.
You know, it was really flagged. But I believed him when he got the whistle and he would, like, he suddenly switched to believe, which was less of a switch for the mother, because the mother kind of still loves, you know, her ex-husband.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Has a fondness for him, they're co-parents, whereas the relationship between him and the stepfather is much more antagonistic.
It is.
So the switch there is a harder thing to pull off, and I think he does.
But I'm really happy it didn't go down the whole train of, oh, you know, suddenly the new man is, you know, if they fall back in love and the new man's gone sort of thing. They always play on that sort of, you know, they're divorcees, but then they come back together and they're together again in the end with the family. And they're all together.
It's the divorce happy ending.
Yes. Yeah.
And the one that Mrs. Doubtfire skipped around too, which we should talk about one day too.
Yes, we should, yeah.
I also thought Peter Boyle was wasted.
Yeah.
So Peter Boyle is probably best known as either the young Frankenstein monster or more recently as the dad in Everybody Loves Raymond.
He's brilliant.
He plays the boss and he's got almost nothing to do.
The boss in Johnny Dangerously.
Well, I meant in this film.
I
haven't seen Johnny Dangerously either. I'm really batting 1,000 here. But
that is something we should actually talk about one day.
Is it? Okay. So Peter Boyle is a good comic actor and he's got almost nothing to do. And in fact, when you said in your intro that you know, it took a long time to get to the Christmassy bit. Yeah. In fact, it threw away all the opportunities about the transition. You had a few jokes and so on, but the woman who he seems to be a good colleague with at the Christmas party at the start, and who then is looking at him askance when he's eating all the comfort food and they're all eating grilled chicken and salad, I thought that might turn into a story where she sees an opportunity to, like, ditch her rival. None of that happened. There was all this stuff that was just completely untouched, and I find the film a bit lost in what it's trying to be as well.
Yeah.
The other bit I really liked, it was just a moment in the film, was the police lineup.
Mm-hmm.
The police get involved because the mother and the stepfather think that the Scott Calvin character, initials SC, like Santa Claus, which is a little joke, which that's fine.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah, the monogram on his red pyjamas.
Yeah.
Being the only thing that makes him think maybe it wasn't all a dream. But the police line up is because they think that the dad has kidnapped the young boy, and so all the police are out, you know, combing the streets looking for them, and the only description is he looks like Santa. So they pull up a whole lot of Santas and put in the police line up and tell them, you know, to turn to the left and one turns to the right. And the mother's looking at them, and, you know, they're quite clearly not a husband, but all they've got to go on is, you know, it's Santa.
It's Santa.
That was funny. But again, for me, those little funny moments were sprinkled across the film where I kind of thought, no, I'm not engaged. I'm not engaged. I didn't mind the child actor. I think the one in the finished film is better.
Yeah, but I thought everybody was competent in it. I didn't think anybody was bad at all.
I just didn't engage. And I do feel bar humbug saying, because I haven't loved any of these three films.
Yeah, yeah, you haven't.
Normally I really like at least one of them. Even Krampus, which is not my typical Christmas film.
Yeah, but we're quite... Yeah, that was quite...
I think we were both quite taken with that.
We were.
We thought the ending fell apart a bit, but we both enjoyed it.
Mm.
And I was expecting that from our finished film. I knew I didn't like this film, but I'd forgotten that I just didn't like it.
I did feel the Christmas spirit, though. After watching three of them, I did feel Christmassy.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
You sure that didn't come from the Netflix film?
No.
I thought that was the most Christmassy of the lot.
No, not at all. I felt Christmassy after watching these three.
I thought the ending was a nice rounding out. But as a film overall, no, not so much. Have you seen the two sequels?
No.
They go downhill.
Really? Oh, well.
The second one is his
hunt. They usually do.
Yeah. The second one is about his hunt for Mother Christmas, Mrs. Claus.
Oh, wow.
And the third one is he takes on his arch enemy, Jack Frost, played by Martin Short.
Oh, my goodness.
And Martin Short's another actor that I kind of like what he does, but I can't really watch him too much. And for me, that kind of, you know, is the bottom of that particular well. So, for this particular film out of the three, what are you giving it?
I'm giving it a 6 out of 10.
And what did your son think? Because your son, who's 9, just about turned 9.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But I saw him ticking over.
Meaning
at the very beginning. No, at the very beginning about all the
processing. Processing the idea.
Yeah.
Well, I watched it with my wife and my younger son, who's 14, so he's a bit older. And I asked them at the end what they gave it. My wife gave it a 4. She didn't care much for it at all. My son gave it a 7. He liked it, but he wasn't that engaged by it. And so if this film speaks more to little kids, then your problem about, is Santa real? Becomes even more problematic. For me, it was a 5. It was competent. There were some moments, but it didn't do Christmas for me.
That's a shame.
I want a Christmas film. Ricardo, get me a Christmas film that I'm going to love. Something I haven't seen before, because I'll watch It's a Wonderful Life again, because I love It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, yes, we both love that
one. And I cry every time. You've only watched it once, haven't you?
No, I've saw it twice. I watched it again.
This year?
After we...
Got to watch it again this year. Everybody, got to watch it again. It's a Wonderful Life.
Amazing. Well, that concludes our Christmas special for 2018.
And for us, Christmas 2018 is particularly special.
That's right, it is. We actually went to number one on the iTunes podcast charts, which was very special. So thank you to all of the listeners.
We have been remarkably stoked.
Yeah, absolutely.
Partly because we didn't expect it.
Yeah, so number one in the television and film category. So amongst some very good company. So thank you so much for listening and subscribing and tuning in.
And for giving us that Christmas present.
Yes, exactly. So it makes us want to, you know, just keep going.
Just before we wrap up, I just want to tell you that, you know, I like to bring these little things to Christmas, as you know.
Yes.
And what I really wanted to have tonight and it'll have to be a future year. I wanted to find a little Santa toy or Christmas card or something that would do the good old ho, ho, ho.
Yeah.
And I couldn't. There was nothing.
Sure.
The closest I could find is our little friend here, Mickey Mouse.
Oh, wow.
And so this is going to have to be the equivalent of our Christmas message. I hope they're not breaking any copyright
cute.
There.
It's very cute.
It's cute, but really, in the end, my heart belongs to Santa, so let's go out with Santa.
Okay, well, let's say Merry Christmas, everyone, and have a very safe and happy new year.
And...